Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And I'm Philip Sage with ARMS Reliability in Australia.
Well, good morning to you, Phil. It's late afternoon here, and I'm through the miracle of Zencasters, the package that we're using. You know, it just dawned on me, as you mentioned, you're the other side of the world. There's like almost no lag, right? There's no, I know there is, there has to be, physically there has to be, but it seems to work pretty good.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Even when you watch like the CNN news, you see delays and lags where they hand over the broadcast to a colleague. And Zencaster and the National Broadband Network in Australia today is connected to the United States pretty tightly. Delay at all.
Yeah. No, I mean, fundamentally, there has to be a delay. It's like we haven't beat that speed of light thing yet, and we're pushing it through fiber or cable of some sort. But anyway, I was just thinking, I'm getting older. My wife's birthday was just the other day. And I was having a couple of conversations with people on LinkedIn that had questions and a few others that came up. But I remember sitting in physics class, and I wanted to mention it to you because I know you're a physicist also at heart, if not else. And
I'm a closet physicist.
There you go. And so I'm sitting down. We got a quiz or a test or something like that, and we had to account for the spin, this phenomena on an atom. And I'm sure you remember the right hand rule, right?
Yes.
You curl your fingers, which goes counterclockwise, and on your right hand, your thumb points in the direction of the spin, and in this case, up. And is the way I'm holding, you can't see it, but I'm holding my hand doing the right hand rule the way I learned it. And it's a way to double check that you've got the right sign on the spin. And so I'm diligently going through this quiz, and I got to check my sign on this thing. And so I have a pencil in this hand, and I'm thinking, and I curl my left hand and get the spin exactly wrong, of course. And I did it all the way through the test. And the professor said, I only marked you off the one time, but because you were incredibly consistent doing the left-hand rule all the way through it. Now, if you could learn to put a big, opposite sign on that thumb, then you'd be fine.
fantastic. Yeah. It's in our Western training that we're taught the right hand rule. We also use it in electromagnetics to link up current and the electric field and the magnetic field, which circulates a conductor, for example.
Right.
But not everybody in the world does it that way. And in fact, when I was in Japan, the Sumitomo Maritime Museum had on display its superconducting submarine engine, which didn't have any moving parts and actually propelled the submarine by creating water thrust. And it did that by combining a high electric charge to establish an electric field and then a circulating superconducting magnetic field that then created thrust. But as the interesting thing was, as I stood in front of the display with my right hand, things were backwards until I realized that they were actually using a left-hand rule and accounting for the fact that when we consider electrical current goes from a positive to a negative terminal, the actual electrons go the other way. So they were actually modeling the actual electron flow. And it took me about 40 minutes standing in the museum in front of that superconducting motor to finally come to grips with the fact that it would work, and it did work, and that there had to be a left-hand rule being used.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to go all the way back to Ben Franklin he put us on the wrong track about that. That's what I understand.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that brought me back, though, the conversations I was through LinkedIn that I was having with people. Is it was one of them that just, it gets under my skin. It took me a few days to settle down to give them an answer. It was, Well, I put the data in this, you know, in I'll leave it unnamed, a software package, and I got in a result. And so it must be true.
Oh, no.
You've never seen that, right? You've never heard that from anybody.
No, never. It happens so often that it just, it's a common problem all around the world, Fred.
But why is that? No, I don't know, for some odd reason, we enjoy digging into the math and reading the history and background and theory and all that stuff. And there's a limit. I have to take it in small doses, but if I'm going to use the Arrhenius equation, for example, I'll dig into the paper. Why did they use that to start with? And it has some nice properties. So you see it used too often, I imagine, but it also has a connection to a fundamental chemistry theorem or theory or law or whatever. And, you know, an Arrhenius said, well, if you increase the temperature, the equation will, or the reaction will happen more often. And he gave some formulas, had some experiments and showed this, and it's been well documented. But then I see it used on crack propagation, or I see it used on, well, I'm going to put my entire box in the chamber and raise the temperature, and I'll use the Arrhenius equation to determine whether it's a good or not. And I'm like, wait a second, back up here, guys. Come on. You got to at least think about it a little bit, what you're trying to do here. And I was like, but it points to a much more, I think, a deeper problem is that we get taught in a lot of our classes, especially in the engineering classes I've taken over the years, how to apply a formula, right? We might see the derivation, but we then are taught, well, in this circumstance, use this formula and plug the numbers in it, do the arithmetic, and you're done. Yeah.
Plug and chug.
Yeah, plug and chug. And then we called it spec and dump. We could learn enough to pick out the right formula. And then because we crammed for it, then it would be forgotten the next day. Whereas in my physics classes, it was always more at the understanding the theory and understanding the being able to do the derivation on your own. And, yep. And one of the things, I had one professor that did it all the time, is that he would present a problem and say, just guess what the answer is. Just use your gut intuition and guess and write it down. Yep. Right. And we had to write it down in their quizzes and tests. Here's my guess. And then you work it out, and then you now have something to check it against, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, if a ball's rolling down an inclined plane to a ramp and it's going to fly some distance, it's like 2 feet, right, or whatever. But if your calculations end up with minus 25 feet, you're probably wrong.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I think in today's world, the universities, and I teach at university, so I know a little bit about what's happening. But I think that as a broad statement, a lot of the coursework is no longer teaching at the level that the physics class you were just mentioning was. And I was taught to start with the conservation of momentum and the conservation of energy and derive all the equations by thinking. And that was often challenging, I have to admit. But if you could take it back to those fundamental theorems, then you were in a better place to understand and advance the problem. Whereas I also have an engineering degree, and that coursework was remarkably different in that it was a structured learning process of application of existing formulas. Mm-hmm. And I used to call it plug and chug. So yep. I think it's rooted in the way that we teach courses, and the result is, as we transition into the software packages that we use for reliability, for example, we won't name any specific package. They're all pretty good, but they all have limitations that were, and those limitations are a result of the way in which the developer implemented the theory. So,
well, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there's dozens of packages out there, and I've used a good number of them and enjoy using them. They're a great tool. I mean, if I go out into my garden and want to dig a hole to plant something, I go grab a shovel. It's the right tool, right? Now, I have to admit, I don't know the theory of the how that metal was formed, and I could, you know, I could probably sort out a lot of that stuff. But I think that problem is that we have a wide array of tools, and we're used to just grab the tool you need, plug, you know, apply it, and off you go. But I think at some point in our engineering world, that breaks down. Some of our tools are too flexible. They can do anything, and they will always, like our calculators, just a simple calculator, right? You can put two numbers in there and multiply and add and everything else. But if you hit the wrong number and hit enter, you will get a number. It will show you an answer, and it will proudly display that number as being true and correct, independent of that you made a mistake on the data entry. It didn't care. Yeah. It didn't know.
Well, the thing is, another example, Fred, would be Microsoft Excel or any kind of spreadsheet application. They're very versatile. They can adapt and do so many things. And the good thing about, I always say about Excel, I'll pick on a Microsoft for a moment, not that they have a bad product, but...
It's fair game.
Yeah.
Don't worry about that.
So the good thing about Excel, according to Phil, is it can do anything. And then I follow it up and state, the bad thing about Excel is it can do anything, meaning that you are really the driver of that keyboard, and your brains have to transition into that Excel sheet. Otherwise, you have a bunch of numbers.
Yeah. Now, one other aspect I think that's driving this is we picked on education a little bit. We got tools that do miraculous things that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it took a team of people to do, even if they could. But as we also have way too many things to do in a day-to-day operation of a plant, for example, a reliability engineer may be consulting on two projects, working with four vendors, doing failure analysis on six other things, and looking to update some guidelines and checking the dailies, anything new, trends, or anything that's happening, plus attending a meeting, plus, you know, on and on and on. You need time to think. And I think that could be a contributing factor to it, is if I got a tool that can crank out this Weibull plot in 5 minutes, I'm going to use it, right? Compared to doing it by hand and thinking through it. But the trouble is that we stop stepping back and even just doing the gut check, or it just, does this make sense? Is Weibull even the appropriate thing to do here? You know, kind of thing. I think time has got a big factor on this.
It is. The example you just cited of a normal day for a reliability engineer of having to multitask is basically what I see everywhere around the world. Everybody's incredibly busy, and there's very little time to sit and focus and really try to advance a problem. So we're kind of driven in the direction to take a tool and put some information in, and often those tools are provided, or they're things that we have to go out into the market and find somebody that can provide or find a free copy. And as a result, we're not necessarily in every case well-trained, I guess would be the comment I would make. And so in addition to being fast and trying to get a result out due to the pressures and demands of the workplace, we're often using tools perhaps a little bit incorrectly.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of that. I think that's, you know, if we dig deeper into it, there's some finesse on any of these activities or tools we do, is that, and I would submit that we could always do better. Yet one of my first bosses said, no, I want you to go work on this. It's not a PhD study, right? It's not a thesis or anything. Just get me enough so I can make a better decision. Okay. Yeah. You know, when do you need this? I said, he was honest with me. He says, actually, I needed it yesterday. So if you can get it to me tomorrow, I won't fire you. You know, kind of thing. No pressure, you know, yeah, Fred. Just go solve this and give it to me tomorrow.
Great guy. If you get it by tomorrow, I won't fire you. Oh, love to work for those people.
he was joking, I think. He was actually one of the best bosses I ever worked for. It was Ron. He had all kinds of quirks, and we knew as a team, we knew how to get under his skin so we could you know, get out of doing stuff and get out of trouble. But one of the things he did is he said, and there was five or six of us in his group. This, we were manufacturing engineers essentially for this factory. And he said, I want you to do an experiment every day and document it, right? And we were learning hypothesis testing, and we were learning and design of experiments and doing SPC type stuff. And
right.
You know, and we were always looking at ways to run our equipment more efficiently, reduce scrap rate. I mean, those were all the, and they're common drivers in many, many factories.
Yep.
But what, and in some days you're busy and you had very little time. So I actually did one about, my hypothesis was the button on the side of the water fountain cooler thingy we had with a little water dispenser yep. for drinking water. If you push the button in partway, you would get a half height on the stream. If you push it in all the way, we'd go full height. And so I measured it, and I tried to work out the relationship between how much force you pushed on it versus how high the water would be. And so I had a little force little meter there measuring how much force I was applying to it and measuring. And my colleagues were looking at me like, what the hell are you doing? You lost it. So I got to get my experiment done. This is the quickest one I could think of before the deadline.
Brent's out at the water fountain again. Come look.
That's great.
We don't know what he's doing, but he's got to be crazy. He's been out to the water fountain 13 times this week. So
that's right. Yeah. But what I did is I learned how to, you know, I drew a basic correlation. I had an hypothesis. I gathered some data. I was able to test my hypothesis and found a relationship that, you know, but I learned how to use the force meter, which I had never used before. I thought, I got this new thing. What do I do with this? Let's go measure this. And what doing that every single day, I find looking back on it over these years, is that I look for experiments everywhere. It's just inherent now. It's just what I do, you know? And I know that if I ask a question, I can go figure it out if I want to. That's powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that, it sounds like you had a great boss that was really in tune with your, and a great communicator, even though you joked a little bit about getting under his skin, but a great relationship in that he helped you develop a keen sense of awareness that is an absolute essential thing for a reliability engineer to have. And I would advocate, while SPC probably doesn't have the same fame that it had back 30 years ago, that every reliability engineer should probably be formally trained in some of the Six Sigma Black Belt type of environment to pick up those tools so that they can look at and really transition into the problem-solving world of not just machine breakdowns and traditional reliability things, but actually to prepare them to participate in operational excellence and highly performance teams that are working on multiple problems and multiple dimensions at the same time.
Well, I had a colleague once that he was looking at root cause analysis, and he wanted to modify it because we can often find, and we did a lot of good work at finding the chemical or physical or the code bug or whatever, the underlying phenomena that was leading to these failures. And he said, there's a second level there. Why didn't we catch that earlier? Why didn't a person in our system have the appropriate information to recognize that issue when it was first designed into the product or created or whatever? So he always looked at it as there's two root causes. One is the physical world, the phenomena that occurred. And then there's the social part about who was in the, who knew what, when, and what information do they have? Why didn't they have the right information in order to spot this sooner and avoid it? And so we were always looking at it. How do we build like the design for reliability set of tools so that we are able to identify what we need to identify at the right time rather than wait for a root cause analysis some point later?
Well, I think, look, you know, you talked about mentors and people that influenced you. I had a great mentor as well. And Greg was a super keen troubleshooter And he helped me tremendously. And if, in fact, I was so proud, Fred, the first time I solved something, went to Greg with it. And you know, he kind of followed along and the rationale and the thinking and the research. And he says, man, you just did a great job, but you missed the most important point. And I said, what do you mean? I've solved the problem. And he says, no. How many more of them are there? And that silence that you just heard was the silence that I couldn't answer that question, right? Yeah. And that's probably the most important question, because, you know, and you were just hitting on an absolutely important topic in that, yes, you had a code bug or you had some transaction or a defect in the product and it got in there, but it's been in there for 8 months or 4 years or 5 years. And nobody's seen it. And that's the other social problem, is that we just can't, you know, understand, or we don't even begin to think about solving those problems because we can't see them. And that's, you know, the whole topic, I suppose, of perception and what we think has happened and or why we've ignored it or we've lived with it or why we haven't even realized that that second problem is there.
Yeah. Well, why don't we break this one and do a summary and come back real quick and talk about perception, because I was also hinting that we got to lead into that. I think it's a brilliant topic.
All right.
You know, a lot of times I want to pick up on topics that we get from our listeners or we get some questions or stuff like that into it. But this one, I think, is, well, let's just call it a two-parter based on some of those discussions I had on LinkedIn that got us started. But the basic idea, I think, of what we started with is that we've got great tools, right? All these different packages, and even Excel, I agree, it's a good package. It does cool stuff. Yet it's just a tool, right? And if you're using a hammer to dig a hole in your garden, you're using the wrong tool. You got to step back and think about, what am I trying to accomplish here? What's the underlying assumptions and built-ins and stuff? Am I applying the appropriate tool? Is the results I'm getting even make sense? You know, those kinds of things. I don't think we work in a world of plug and chug. I think we work in a world where we have to solve problems and provide advice. And I think that takes a different skill level of Absolutely. Just applying the tool. It means we need to think. Yeah. So anyway, that if you know, you listen to this and you agree, or you got some other cool stories about, you know, how you separate thinking versus plug and chug, if I'll use that term to generalize it, you know, let us know. Head over to ascendoverreliability.com/go/SOR. There's a way to get a hold of us there. You can also find us on LinkedIn. You can find us on the about pages on Ascendo. And by and large, a lot of our topics these days, as we approach our 600th episode, by the way, Phil, good number of our episodes are based on feedback from the audience and for questions from the audience. So we certainly appreciate your participation. So with that, Phil, let's hit pause, stop this recording, start a new one, and we'll be right back with another episode.
Part two on the way.
All right. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.